Hey guys, it's Lavetta.
And it's Miriam.
And this is the Notorious Women Podcast, a comedy podcast about some of history's most notorious women.
Yes, yes.
Back again for season six. I cannot believe we're in the sixth season. Can you?
No, I cannot.
It's crazy.
Yeah, season six. I'm so excited.
Yes, yes. You know, what we wanted to do was, remember last episode we talked about possibly reading some of our reviews.
Why, yes, Lavetta, I do remember that. I mean, honestly, but I thought about it separately. And then I just remembered that we actually did, in fact, talk about it. And it was not an original thought at all.
And I think we should read some of them. I mean, we don't have to read all of them. I'll read like a few. And then we can sort of like throughout this season, we'll start reading some. And then if you post new comments, we'll read those first.
Yes, we
listeners.
Will.
So please make sure you do that.
Good reviews.
Yeah.
I can't take criticism. I'm too emotional. Thank you.
You can't take criticism. You were so funny. Okay. So let me pull some up here. Why is it not? I should have had this up. Okay, there it is.
We're very professional in season six.
Yes. Okay. Okay. Okay, we have one here from December of last year from Kendra Bingham. I love these ladies. I feel like I'm in the room with them and I love it. I learn so much and they look forward to hanging out with them every week.
Yes.
Thank you, Kendra. Another one from last year also is from September of last year. Five stars. Fascinating stories told and dissected by two outstanding, insightful, hilarious hosts.
Oh, thank you so much.
You're going to make a black girl blush. Oh. And that is from 16VCTVC. So, yes. And this is from Miranda MMF. I might not have that right, so excuse me, Miranda, from last year as well. This show is so interesting and great to hear about trans people in history. Lavetta and Miriam are also a whole lot of fun. Definitely a must listen.
Okay. Tell your friends. Thank you.
Yes. So there you have it. There's just a few. Again, if you want to also tell us that we're pretty and smart lovely.
Yeah.
You can do that in the Apple Store. Give us a 5-star review and leave something sweet and we will read it on the air.
Yes.
So let's get started. I have a fun one this week and I believe I am first because last week, Miriam, you were first.
So believe you because why would you lie? Listen,
I
have two kids
all the time.
is this whole thing a ruse? Is this whole friendship?
Yeah, yeah.
Am I finding out right now?
Don't you know I love to talk? When I was a kid growing up in elementary school, they'd be like, "She's so smart, but she talks a lot."
Do you know what's really weird? Growing up in elementary school, I was really smart, but I had no self-esteem, and I was very, very, very quiet. It's very true.
Really?
I know.
I don't believe you. I'll believe you, Miriam.
You know who really doesn't believe me?
Who?
It's my husband.
When did that change? When did you stop being like?
I think like high school, like middle of high school, like middle to end of high school.
So sophomore year, junior year.
Junior year. You know what happened? Y'all joined the band. I was in band and
gotcha.
I played the alto saxophone.
You're with your peeps.
Thank you for loving. My husband loves nothing more than stories of me in the band.
Miriam, you there? Did I lose her?
It's saying trying to connect.
Oh.
But maybe I'm connecting.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on there.
Am I back?
Yeah, you're here.
Okay, good. Yeah, can you edit that out?
There's no need. We're all friends here.
Oh, okay. You guys, technical glitches.
I know. Technical glitches, but...
All right, fine. Lavetta just turned her camera off. Fine.
No, see if it works. Let's see if it works. If not, this is all behind the scenes, guys. But anyway, but so it changed in like when you were, you joined the band, you said. So
I joined the band and it was epic. And now I'm forcing my children to join the band. What happened was I was made section leader. That's right. I was the section leader. I like to brag about it and I'm going to brag about it right now. And then that year I was the section leader to 7 freshmen, all boys, all taller than me. And I had to like, you know, keep them in line. And then you just had no choice. I had no choice.
Yeah, that'd do it too.
And then, here I am. So
yeah,
if you want any more band stories, I have so many. Okay.
Nerd. Anyway,
We're proud of that. Okay.
A nerd calling another nerd a nerd. Yeah, that's.
I know. Like, tell me more about Star Trek, Lavetta.
Hey, I will not have any any harsh words about Star Trek, or yes, there might be fighting up in here. Okay.
Exactly.
Live long and prosper. So, on that note, so. This, yes, I am first this week. So let's get started. So my Notorious Woman this week in honor of Black Music Month.
Okay.
Which is June. Last week I covered Lisa Left Eye Lopez, who had a birthday, prior to that episode dropping because we took a bit of a break. So rest in power, Queen Left Eye.
Listen. I was like obsessed with that, by the way. I was.
Oh, were you?
I was sharing. I was like, did you know? She was helping people in South America. My husband was like, calm down. But we don't talk about that. And that's why we're here.
I know. Let's see.
All right. Are you ready to rumble?
I'm moving. I'm getting my stuff ready. Hold on. Okay. So my Notorious Woman this week in honor of Black History Month in the month of June is...
Black music.
Millie Jackson.
Okay.
Do you know who that is?
Absolutely not. Because I'm a white, ignorant human born and raised in America. So please tell me.
You may not know. She is a firecracker. Oh, this is going to be fun. Okay. So Millie Jackson, a.k.a. the original queen of raunchy rap, a.k.a. the queen of raunch, a.k.a. the queen of raunchy soul.
Yes. I love her. Who is she?
Okay. So Millie Jackson was born in Thompson, Georgia, to Jubilee Jackson, a sharecropper. Okay. Unfortunately, I couldn't find her mother's name because, and tragically, when she was about 2, her mother died in a fire.
Oof.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, poor baby. Afterwards, she and her brother David were sent by their father to live with her mother's family. In Thompson, and like a small little town outside of Georgia. I happen to know because my family's from the South, but a lot of times they'll be like, I'm not from Thompson. I'm from like the smaller town than Thompson, even though Thompson's smaller. So
really,
but Millie says that only lasted about 18 months because her father was very close to she and her brother. He loved his kids.
Oh,
and
that's wonderful.
He was determined to stay with his kids. And so they eventually actually moved to Hoboken, New Jersey.
Hoboken.
Yeah, Hoboken. So that they're part of that migration, one of the many, many migrations, great migrations from the South to the North for Black people in the United States. So,
What year around? What is this? Like?
So in about 1958.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. She was born in 1944.
Okay.
So, but when she was about 2 and 46, her mother had a terrible, like I said, a terrible accident.
Right.
That killed her mom. So, yeah, terrible. But her dad was like determined and he was very close to his children. So he actually, she said basically he married like five or six other times eventually. Whoa. Because he was always looking for a stepmother for her.
He's like, I love you. Here are the kids. They have a very complicated schedule. I'm going to go to work.
I mean, also,
and they
it's
were like, okay, peace.
Sharecropping is very, very hard work. It's basically another name. It's certainly better than slavery because you had your freedom. You can go wherever you want to go. But
right.
The pay was like just above subsistence. Like it was just terrible. It was exploitative.
Absolutely.
And it was slavery light. It was just terrible. So I can only imagine her poor mother, who was also probably working with the father in the fields, on their land to, you know, to make their quota of whatever they were cultivating. Then she also has to raise these kids. So the fact that her father was like, oh, without a wife, I can't do this. So we shipped them off.
That's why, like, you know, like when moms are stay at home moms and we judge, it's like, go ahead and replace me. And it's like, do you have $187,000 a year to replace mom? Because that's kind of the cost.
That's
right?
Kind of the cost. So she was always close to her dad. And he was also worried that she would be influenced by the streets because she was becoming a young woman. So that's why at age 14, you know, he was like, yeah, let's get up out of here. So, now by the time she was in her mid-teens, she was in the tri-state area. And she was she also started living with an aunt in Brooklyn, actually.
Okay.
And she did occasional modeling gigs for Jive Magazine and Sepia, which are black stables. Jive and Sepia. Sepia was an offshoot of Jet Magazine. And Jive was like a more of a like a I feel like Jive was like a younger kind of more like teeny bopper thing at first. So, and then I wonder if the magazine came before the record label, cause there was Jive Records.
I wonder.
Well.
Yeah.
So, you know, typical teen, up in the North now. Now in 1964, at the age of 20, she was in a nightclub in Harlem when she, dared to sing, for a competition that they were having for $5 by her friends. And she was like, okay. So she got up, performed and won the money.
Yes. $5. Okay.
And was offered a spot on the stage, for a night at different clubs at that club. And, so she started singing like one-nighters around town, building up her stage presence. And obviously, she could sing because somebody was willing to pay her to sing.
Yep.
And she eventually, all of that led to a tour with Sam Cooke's brother, LC.
Oh, hey.
Yeah. Okay. And she was actually on tour with his brother when they got the news that Sam had died.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, but after 2 years of being out on the road, because touring is tough on you, you know, especially if you're not like the headliner,
no one cares.
You're opening up. Yeah. So she came back to the city and continued doing singing nightclubs and things like that.
Okay.
Now, during that time, she was also, she gave birth to her first child, Keisha Jackson. Aww. And she went back to working. Now, her day job, this woman was a hustler and she's always been a hustler. So her day job was working in the garment district at like a shipping company. And she kept it basically for many years after she started performing because she said she would get $20 off of wholesale prices.
Oh.
For materials, 20% off of wholesale prices.
Damn, that's like, in those days, that's like 14 cents or some shit.
Yeah.
That's
cheap. Like cheap, cheap, cheap. So she, and for those of you who don't know, who don't live in New York City, the Garment District, District is a world renowned like area. Like it's,
in the 30s on the West Side.
Yeah. And she means street 30s. And
oh, yes, I do.
Yeah. They're like 1930s.
No,
and
sorry.
So she basically was like, I kept that job because A, I'm not stupid. But B, she was able to get her own, like, create her own costumes. Like,
I was going to say, this is perfect.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So she just went on leave, and obviously she was good at her job because they let her stay on. And so she came back. So when she came back off a tour with LC, she just took up with her old job and continued singing, you know, singing around the city and looking for a deal, which it did lead to a record deal with MGM Records in 1970.
Wow. Okay.
But while there, she felt like creatively kind of restricted. So she soon left there and began a long association with Spring Records, which is a New York based record company. Now, her performances early on were kind of like in the mold of like your traditional like soul singer. Again, this is now we're in the 70s.
Yes.
And she said that, you know, later on her performance was characterized by she would break out and start talking spoken words in the middle of like the song. And, you know, she said it stemmed from her not being like sure of what to do in front of a crowd at first. So it's kind of like a nervous kind of thing that she used to her advantage and just used to like create this kind of thing that set her apart from other people.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, growing up, she was always kind of like self-conscious. So she learned early on to how to make learn how to make people laugh. So that was infused in when she would be talking. And it always like it was always in relation to what the song was about. So and it's a very like it's a very kind of standard thing that kind of blues, like especially blues when it changed from like old timey blues to more like down and raunchy kind of like blues,
yes.
like the talking and like my old lady left me, da 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 da, you know, that kind of thing that you could just hear at a juke joint like deep in the woods or something in the South.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's her heritage as well. But she brought this to like soul music. So and again, it would always have to do with the subject matter of the song. So it's not like it was just like, oh, like talking about the weather or something. It always, it was always related to the song.
I forgot to buy milk anyways.
So she just said, you know, quote, I just talked to the audience because I was nervous, end quote. And then she goes on to say, then my label Spring wanted to record it like I was doing it in the live show. It was no longer than a 3-minute single of this one single that they were thinking about doing it, but not quite a whole album side. So I said, we need to keep this story going. So it was also a filler, a way to fill the song. Because the 70s had some long ass songs. I can't even lie. Like, it just went on and on and on.
Eight minutes was the short version, you know?
Yeah. So because of this, because she, you know, she was creating her own style, record executives early on didn't quite know if she were blues or R&B. Blues was much more of a smaller category at this time, but R&B was a much bigger category. So
that's R&B. Why sounds good.
Yeah, but they didn't quite know because, again, the talking aspect.
Right.
You know, this is also of like the comedy albums. It kind of had that feel and it was just sort of down home. Basically, these record executives, probably white people who don't know black people, because black people are like, clearly that's R&B. Blues is about like losing your blues is country music. Basically, you lose your dog, your woman. And your job. So R&B is about making love or love problems.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
So, you know, her career kind of stumbled a little bit because, again, the executives didn't really know what to do with her at that time. But she persisted and she went on because she's like, hey, I'm working.
Right.
Now, she was working with the label's in-house producer, Rayford Gerald, on her first song, which was called A Child of God. It's Hard to Believe, from 1971.
Okay.
Which reached the number 22 spot on the R&B charts. Now, funny thing about this song is that so they back then they would send it out to DJs. They would send it out because they're trying to get it played. That's how, you know. So somebody at the company, though, at the record company, thought it was a gospel song. A Child of God.
Oh, my God. Well, right. But, okay.
So they didn't really listen to it before sending it out to gospel stations who listened to it like, why are you sending us this film? So a little mix up. It's like, guys, just listen to it before you send it out. So,
wow.
Yeah. But that reached number 22 on the R&B charts. Now, in 1972, she had her first R&B top 10 single with Ask Me What You Want.
Okay.
Which also reached the top 30 on the non-R&B main charts. And then she also had a song called My Man, A Sweet Man, which reached number 7 on the R&B charts and number 50 on the UK singles charts.
Okay.
All the songs were co-written by her. So she was always, and I'm going to get a little bit into that. Like, she is really a self-made woman in so many ways. And yeah, she just kind of like exemplifies what it's like to be a woman in general. Like, you just have to do shit yourself a lot of times.
Yeah.
So early on it was, again, it was like, you know, even though she was doing the spoken word, it was just traditional kind of R&B. So, she had some success because, I mean, she charted, which is amazing.
Right.
But she still found it difficult to distinguish herself from, there's so many soul singers. Like, I mean, America is the home of soul for Black people. And
let me be real. It's America's very sad. And so we have to adjust for it by singing our souls out. That's kind of what it is, right?
Yeah. And it's like it's American, you know, rooted genre. And there's so much talent in, like, and again, she's from the South. Like, it's so funny, when American Idol first started, I'd watch and I would not be that impressed, especially after the second or third season. Cause I was like, I know people sing better than this every day, every Sunday in the church. Like, it's really not that hard. And then I was amazed at some of the people that got through. But anyway, there's a lot of Fantasias and J-Huds throughout the Black communities in America. There's a lot of them. And they know that, too. That's why they're, like, representing. Don't mean they can't sing now. Don't get me wrong. But especially if you grew up in the church, it's a lot of singers who don't look the part. But they have the talent. So, and not everybody wants to be a singer and out in front. So a lot of people want to stay in, they want to stay in church. You know?
Yeah, they want to do once a week.
So then, my point is that she had a lot of competition. And so she was like, how can I figure out a way to distinguish myself? And off stage, she had been called sort of like, again, in these live shows, she had been referred to as the female Richard Pryor.
What?
because she knew how to curse really, really well.
Okay, like, yes. And, oh, my God. I love her.
And Richard Pryor was considered, you know, very filthy and quote unquote blue. Yeah. Even though he was like, you know, became very mainstream and a mainstream, you know, an icon. But so she thought, you know, she also said that at the time, a lot of the girl singers she thought were boring. She just thought, like, they were kind of prissy and, you know, she's just like, So she wanted to do what the men were doing. And the men were allowed to be a little bit more raunchy, a little bit more down earthy, quote unquote. So she was just like, I want to do what the men are doing. So she started on, you know, introducing the 4-letter words.
Oh, girl. It
took a little while to actually get to the recordings. You know, because this is before YouTube or anything like this. So you literally had to put music out through the record, like being recorded.
Yep.
You know, and people didn't really record live stuff unless you were a star or that was the purpose. But that's so she started incorporating a little bit more of the raunch. you know, because she's just like, I need to come up with a gimmick. You know, I said, you got to have a gimmick.
Got to get a gimmick.
Yep. And she noticed
keep singing,
that.
But I'll stop.
Yeah. She noticed that whenever she would drop the 4-letter words, the audience would get like really activated. Right. So she's a performer. She wants her audience to have a good time. So in 1974, she released the album Caught Up, which introduced her innovative style of raunchy spoken words.
Okay.
So the first time on record that the new style was heard was in a song called If Loving You Is Wrong. If loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right. I think that's a blues song. Anyway.
I know the song.
You know what? I don't know if you guys had it out here, but side note. When I was growing up, they used to have these, like, I don't know if it was like late at night, but they'd have like these compilation, like, cassettes or CDs or what have you, and they'd be like old timey songs, like they'd be the blues ones, and
100%. And I definitely had, I think I had not a blues one. Yeah, I had like, I don't know, it was like Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. But they would play one, and I don't know if it's like a local station in Florida or whatever, but they would play this one, and it was definitely old blues, and it'd be like, "Who's making love to your old lady?" And it'd be these old, like, black men, "Why you been out making love?" You know, and then it's like, Clarence Carter, "I've been stroking." It's just like, but it would play, it's a commercial, so it would play on a loop. And it's just like, so this song, "If Loving You Is Wrong," because it's a cover of another artist's song.
Yes.
But her version is when she started talking. So she's singing the verses, and then she would add her spoken word element to it. Again, it was a bit of a gimmick, but it totally worked.
Because
it was so mad. It was a huge hit. She got nominated for a Grammy for it.
Yes.
Like, it was so, I mean, she also said she didn't realize that people started picketing outside the record company because they thought it was filth and it was raunchy. It was too raunchy.
Yeah. Don't listen to it then. That's fine.
I mean, she was like, "Hey, I mean, the people love it. I got a Grammy nomination." Now the Grammy nomination, another side note, there's a few side notes here. She was nominated along with Aretha Franklin that year.
Wow.
For the Grammys. Now, she recently, about 2 years ago on Questlove's podcast, Questlove Supreme, she and her daughter are on there being interviewed. It's a two-part interview. I highly recommend you guys go and find it out after you listen to this episode, of course. And she was pissed about that because she said that Aretha, that they were so pissed off at like her being included and some of the other women, that they nominated Aretha Franklin for a record that was 2 years old. It didn't even qualify.
Oh, like, no.
And so
that's
she was
shitty.
Pissed. So when she got there, I mean, they all went, because you get nominated for a Grammy, you go to the Grammy Awards, and all the other women kind of knew, but Aretha won. But it was for a song that was 2 years old. So she was so pissed about that. But she was nominated for that, "If Loving You Is Wrong," her version. Now, also in that interview, she talks about how, like, she and Aretha Franklin, again, this is the 70s, had the same booking agent. She said basically the booking agent booked everybody that was black, like in the tri-state area. Gotcha. So she still had her day job. She still had her day job.
Right.
And she, after work, she would go up to the booking agency, because what's the deal? Like, you got me any bookings? Da da da. And she would see Aretha, and Aretha would never speak to her when she saw her.
That's shitty.
One day she saw her in the hallway and stepped in front of her.
Okay.
And Aretha's like, "Oh, okay." So she tries to go around. She wouldn't let her. So she steps again. And then she said to Aretha, "Hello, Aretha." And Aretha said, "Hi." And she said, and then Millie's like, "That's all. I just come up here every day after I get off from work and I see you and you don't speak. So I was determined that you were going to say hello to me today. You can go on about your fucking business now," end quote.
Oh, okay. Yes, I need respect and I'll respect you. I think you have a song about it. I don't know.
I think it's so funny because people forget that Aretha Franklin comes from a pretty well-off family. People forget that about her. Like, her father was a pastor, but they were like pretty well-off. So she grew up like pretty well-off. Not Millie.
Yeah, no.
Millie from the South, and she grew up as a teenager in the tri-state area. So Millie was like, I love it. She's like, "Now you can go on about your fucking business." That'd give you some insight into her persona and her personality. Now, in a 1980 interview, when asked if she liked to curse on stage, it was this really provocative interview that was done in the UK by a British, a female reporter who was really, I could tell it was a really good interview. And it was just very laid back. I loved it. And people were so elegant, I felt, even in the 1980s. I got strong Dynasty vibes, like by their hair, makeup. And both of them are well turned out, but, you know, they looked very well. And she was in a very good mood. She was there. She had a performance that evening. Okay. And in the interview, in 1980 interview, the interviewer asked her, you know, if she likes to curse on stage. And she said, quote, "Yes, it's just the shock. I like to shock people. Be it dirt or be whatever. It's just the kind of, it's just the idea of seeing the expression on their face when I say it." End quote. So, and then it's so funny because I saw another interview around the same time where this who looked a lot like Bill O'Reilly. I don't think it was him, but it looked like a very, very young Bill O'Reilly. I don't know. This guy was asking her. And he was kind of like, he was kind of judging her, this interviewer, and is in America, about like her raunchiness. And, you know, she's just like, I just love to, again, I like to shock people. I like the look on their face. And so then they go to the audience at her concert that night. And one said, quote, I think she's downright gutsy, earthy, funky. She's today. She's 1980. Millie is for real, end quote.
Yes.
And then another fan was like, quote, it's as though she's really experienced what she's talking about, end quote. Because also another aspect of her music was you call it side chick music. Basically, it's like a married, it's like a woman, a mistress talking about like the tough part about dating a married man. And it's from her point of view. So it's some wrong stuff that people did not talk about on record in polite society.
I mean, except for Whitney Houston.
I mean...
Right.
But again, remember, Whitney, it's like if you're not really listening to the words and you're just looking at the presentation, you're like, you know, and what she was referring to is You Give Good Love, right?
No, it's older than that. It's there's like more than one.
Yeah, it's Saving All My Love for You.
Saving All My Love. Listen.
A Few Stolen Moments is all. Yeah.
I love that song. And I was 26 when I realized what it was about.
And because Whitney's like 19 or 20 singing that song too.
Oh yeah. That's probably none of that happened, but it's her. Yeah. We're talking about another person right now. I understand that, but it's a beautiful song anyways.
Yeah. So,
but you're right. Cause it's kind of covered in like the beautiful music.
Yeah. But not
she's
Millie.
Like what I said was, and then this happened.
Millie's like, you know, the hard thing about dating a married man, that he's got to fuck his wife before he fucks you. Like, that's the kind of stuff that she was delivering. Now, in a 2020 interview in the UK, she said that early on, like when she got into this very provocative kind of persona, women loved her and the men hated her.
Yeah.
Because she was like on Saturday morning, and again, this is the 70s, on Saturday morning when the men had stayed out all night without a woman and coming up in the middle of the dawn, they still sleep. So the women would get up in the morning on Saturday to do their chores and play Millie Jackson.
Yeah, they would.
Because she said the women wanted to let their men know that, quote, you've been out all night. So damn too damn bad. I'm playing Millie Jackson.
That's right.
So to tell you about yourself.
Yes, Millie Jackson. I love you.
Now, after her style switch, she switched producers too to work more with Brad Shapiro, who also helped her with a big hit she had called It Hurts So Good and Love Doctor. Hurts So Good was actually have you ever seen Cleopatra Jones, which is one of my favorite movies?
No.
Cleopatra Jones. I'm more Cleopatra Jones than Foxy Brown. It's of the blaxploitation kind of film. And because Cleopatra Jones, Tamara Dobson plays this spy. She's basically James Bond. She's like 6 feet tall.
Nice.
She has a huge afro.
Okay.
And she has a long leather coat. Like, I think they billed it as like the female Shaft. She was so beautiful too, because Tamara Dobson was a supermodel. Like, gorgeous.
Yeah.
And like, I think in the opening scene, she comes in like she's in the she does like this action sequence. So she's like in the airport or whatever. She's just so fucking cool and so beautiful. And in it, it's there's a very tasteful love scene with the leading man. And Hurt So Good is the song that's featured in that scene. Big deal.
Yeah.
Now she also worked at the renowned Alabama studio, Muscle Shoals Studio, which is world renowned. And she continued just recording, because now she's like really cooking. Like, she's got this new persona. There's nobody out there like her. Also, she was saying that she had to switch it up because disco was drowning out everything.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Disco had taken over everything. So Donna Summer, who, you know, we may cover her. We definitely will get to Miss Donna Summer at some point.
Yeah, kind of got it.
She was like the queen of the charts, but disco was everywhere. Everything, everybody was turning everything into disco. And she also did a little bit of that, but that was one of the reasons she needed to switch up her style to just distinguish herself.
Yeah, get it.
So she also, her follow-up album still caught up. She had hit singles, My Man, A Sweet Man, that were also hits in the UK. And then a 1976 song, A House for Sale, was okay. also a hit. And then the following year brought her third U.S. R&B top 10 hit. It, like I said, Hurt So Good, which charted, and it was in that film. And then her number three on the R&B charts, it hit number three on the R&B charts, number 24 okay. on the Billboard charts. And then it became a big hit also overseas. She was busy.
Wow. She was busy and very successful.
Now, and despite all of this, she managed to give birth to her son, Jerrall.
How many kids?
So she has two children.
She has two. Okay.
So she had her daughter, in the 60s and then her son, in the 70s. So she was a busy, busy woman. And she is reported, she is on record as saying that, because they were like, oh, you know, especially back then, both of your children, you have two children from two different men and you've never been married. And she's like, yeah. She's like, I wanted kids. I didn't want a husband.
Listen, I want her to be happy. So this works out.
But she's saying this in the 80s. And she's like, yeah. She's like, actually, my daughter was, you know, was a surprise. But she's like, my son was planned, actually. I wanted a kid. I wanted kids, but I didn't want a husband. So she's like, because my career is so important to me. And she's like, the fathers are in their life, you know, whatever. Like, but I make enough money to take care of my children. So,
yeah, that's
like,
yeah.
There's no shame. Like, there's you know,
I love that she was no shame. I love that she was like, obviously, everything's fine. Love
yeah,
that.
And she broke it down like what we all know. She's like, yeah, she's like, I have a, I wouldn't be able to have my career and be married and have kids and a husband. She's like, so I chose a husband. I chose kids and my career over a husband.
Yeah, because so, it's so, like if you can afford it, yeah, less stress.
She's like, and I can afford it. So yeah. Now over the next 10 years, she had a string of successful albums and numerous R&B chart entries. The biggest being the 1977 version of Merle Haggard's country hit, If We're Not Back in Love by Monday.
Okay.
Yep. She also, like I said, she dipped her toe in the disco arena. She had a disco single called Never Change Lovers in the Middle of the Night.
That's some good advice right there. Okay.
Yeah. Well, in 1979. Now, in a 1978 interview, she said that she was sometimes called the Ann Landers of the Black community.
Okay.
Because often her fan mail, and this is when people were still getting physical fan mail.
Right.
When it was like filtered through her record company or what have you, and it got down to her, a lot of times it would be like, Millie, I'm going with a married man. What should I do? Millie, this man is getting on my nerves. What should I do? So that's another thing that she would give out advice basically in her music, you know, about these different situations.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
She's so helpful.
She's so helpful. And later on, she also, it wasn't just man bashing, because at first men thought it was just man bashing. But she was like, usually when people think that, they haven't listened to the whole song, because a lot of times I'll then tell the other perspective as well.
Right. That you can't help anyone if you don't see other sides. She gets that.
Yeah. And I want to say in all her interviews, she seems like a very happy woman.
Oh, I love that.
And I think it's because she was just independent. Like,
yeah, like, she's living life on her terms.
She's living life on her terms. She's touring around. She's always been touring, but she was touring by the 70s and the 80s. She had been touring around the world. She had gone to Europe and Africa.
Yeah, that's so amazing. Like,
she's just like, she just looks so happy, like in these interviews. Yeah. And I was like, that's so unusual because, you know, that's the narrative. And I think because she always had control over her career, she controlled the narrative.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Now, she continued to record throughout the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s. She had a single in 1986 called If You're Not Back in Love by Monday. Oh, that's the Merle Haggard thing. And then, which ended up charting number 2 on the Billboard country charts.
All right.
And peaked at number 5 on the R&B charts.
Okay.
She also followed it up in 1986 with a single called Hot, Wild, Unrestricted.
I wonder what that's about. Mm-hmm. I think I know.
And then in the 90s, she wrote a song called Young Man, Older Woman.
Ooh.
Which
Cougar?
She turned it into a musical, a play.
Really?
Yeah. So she toured with the play.
Oh my God. Yes. Yeah.
She's written an opera called Fuck You. So she basically lived her life basically in her career in her own terms. She's still living her best life. She's still alive today. She's still living her best life. But basically her career spanned 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s.
Damn.
And in 2000, like the 2010, she released music as well. Over the course of her career, she released 28 albums that collectively sold 40 million copies.
Wow.
Making her one of the most successful under-recognized female artists of the 20th century because of the subject matter, because of the cursing.
Yes.
She wasn't played a lot by radio stations like her contemporaries.
Everything. Now.
Yep. Now, most of her career.
Play it in front of my children.
Yeah. Wait until they get a little bit older, then they'll appreciate it. But now, also, for most, if not all of her career, she managed herself.
Really?
She never had a manager.
So no one stole from her. That's what I just heard.
Ding, 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 ding.
Mm-hmm.
This woman was so like smart. Like she went to night school. She was trying to get a traditional college degree, but she was like some bullshit. And she's like, my career kept pulling me away, but she started taking business classes.
Oh, that's
because
fair.
She said, so in the interview in the 1980s, one of the reasons, because again, the guy was being a little judgmental. He was saying, she was like, yeah, what does a manager do? Because a manager just goes out and finds stuff that I can find myself. I have to say yes to it. So also they're getting a commission. And she basically, at the time they were saying she was making over $550,000 a year, which is over $1 million a year. And out of that, because everybody worked directly for her, she could write off their salaries.
Yes, she could. She's smart. She's smarter than most of us, honestly.
Smarter than most people. And I get it that, you know, and some say that perhaps if she had had like a powerful manager, maybe more would have come her way. She said possibly, but she's like, I always liked having control over my image, over things I said. She's like, everything I did, I wanted to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
She also wrote and produced co-wrote or co-produced most of her work.
Listen, and she's still around?
She's still around. In 2006, 5 of her best-selling albums, Millie Jackson and Hurt So Good, Caught Up, Still Caught Up, and Feeling Bitchy were digitally remastered and re-released in CDs with bonus tracks.
Okay.
all of her Spring Records era albums are available from Ace Records in the UK. An Imitation of Love was reissued in 2013.
Okay.
And other albums released on the Jive and Ichiban labels remain out of print, though. Though some of those songs are on compilation albums. Now, in 2012 documentary Unsung, the story of Mildred Millie Jackson aired on TV One. And I watched part of this. She was performing at the historic Washington, D.C. Howard Theater.
Okay.
And B.B. King's Blues Club in New York that year. She was also inducted in 2015 into the official Rhythm and Blues Music Hall of Fame in Clarksdale, Mississippi.
Well, that took a long time, but we got there.
We got there. Today, she's still thriving. She continues to be a spitfire. In 2014, she released Millie Jackson on the Country Soul Countryside, basically a country album.
Yeah.
Because she said she loved, again, she's from the South, so she grew up loving country music, but she said she listened to this one song on the radio. I was driving one day, and the guy's like, "Durnum, durn, I'm a redneck, porn view." And she's like, "Oh, hell no." So she's like, so she did her own thing. Durn, 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 and a black bitch, porn view.
Yes!
And like I said, she just in 2022, a couple of years ago, she was on Questlove's podcast an interview with her daughter, because her daughter, Sheila, is really involved in preserving her mother's legacy. Sheila herself is also a singer, and she was actually part of the Atlanta Collective that Outkast was a part of in the 90s. Oh, and yeah. She's also part of a group. Sheila's part of a group of other children of famous musicians.
Okay.
Where they get together and they have activities, they have events. Sheila is also, she was also part of, which is near and dear to my heart. It's called the Yacht Rock. I think it's the Yacht Rock Collective or something like that.
Yeah.
I love Yacht Rock.
Yeah. Oh my God. I think I've heard of this because you introduced it to me.
And so, so Sheila, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree with Millie, and they're very close. And also Sheila is like her mother's twin.
Oh, that's so,
because Millie is a very distinctive look. She has very, very full lips. She's a very sensual woman, you know, even now that she's older. But when you look back, you know, in her heyday, and like, she's a very, like, I wouldn't necessarily call her traditionally beautiful, but she's traditionally sexy. She's a very, very sexy woman.
Yeah,
and it's so funny.
Saying.
In one of those interviews, she was saying that she was like, no, I actually, all the sex I talk about, all my stuff, it's just, she's like, it's just for show. It's like, she's like, I don't have nearly as much sex as I. She's like, I really would love to have that much
she's
sex.
She's like, I'm not mad at it.
But what I loved about her is that literally she's been living her career and her life on her own terms, and she seems so happy.
I love that.
Like, it's the kind of thing that because she's just independent. She did get married once. That lasted about 6 months because exactly what she thought was going to happen. Her husband came in and started talking to other people on her behalf.
Uh-uh.
And she's like, no, we cutting this off at the knee. So, and she's like, they had been together for 2 years, but they were married for 6 months and he just started feeling himself. And she's like, no. She's like, I love men, but I don't need a man.
Yeah.
And I think that, unfortunately, that's what a lot of misogynists are afraid of, that if women don't need them, but what they should want women to want them versus
that's
needing
what,
them.
Yes. How, instead of needing you, how about you make yourself an appropriate kind of human wherein we would want you? And if
we
you don't do that, suck it.
Yep. So that is Millie Jackson. You guys need to check her out. She is basically like, you know, I'm a Megan Thee Stallion girl, or even Lil Kim or Trina, the baddest bitch. People think all of that is new, but no, Millie has been doing it since the 60s and even before her, because you know LaWanda Page, Aunt Esther from, Sanford and Son. You know, Aunt Esther?
Yes.
That's LaWanda. That's LaWanda Page, right? LaWanda Page apparently was a dirty, filthy stand-up comic.
Oh, really?
Like, filthy.
That's weird. I don't like, I can't wrap my head around
it. I know, it's Aunt Esther, but like, yeah. So Millie Jackson is just like, she grew up probably, you know, in the backwoods. Like, you always hear about these dirty things and stuff like this, but Millie is from a proud tradition of raunchy women who say it like a T.I. is. Like, so I love Millie Jackson.
She is amazing. Thank you so much for bringing her into not just my life, but everybody's life. And I'm going to go find what I can of her.
Yeah. Don't listen to it with the kids. It's definitely
absolutely not. You have warned me. Fair enough.
Yeah,
you know,
don't do it with the kids. So
I will not.
So who is your notorious woman this week?
My notorious woman this week. So June is also, as we know, Pride Month.
Yes. Yeah.
I love me some Pride Month. So I am going to talk today about Sylvia Rivera.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So, okay. We know if you kind of know who I'm talking about, we, in my brain place, we kind of lump Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera to the degree wherein I actually have a sticker of both Marsha and Sylvia with their arms around each other. They're sort of, and we've learned, I've learned about Marsha P. Johnson. She's come more into the zeitgeist. I feel like people talk about her more.
Oh, yeah. But I and feel we'll cover her one day,
and
too.
We'll definitely, But like, I feel like we don't exactly know much about Sylvia. She has talked less of, other than, but tell me I'm wrong. Like, you can come at me for that
I mean, yeah, audience, tell us if we're wrong. I think that often they're, because they were BFFs, they were best girlfriends. Yes. So they were often together, I think. And I think that's why. So, and I think because Marsha P. Johnson recently has had like documentaries. But I feel like there's one of Sylvia. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Maybe you'll tell me. But
let's find out.
Yeah.
Actually, I think you might be wrong.
Okay.
But this is her story, and it's a very interesting story. So she was born July 2nd, 1951. She was raised in New York City. Her father was Puerto Rican and her mother was Venezuelan. And when she was just a baby, her father abandoned her. And then her mother died by suicide when she was 3 years old. Aww. Now, poor very baby. Rough start to the world. Aww. I know. So her grandmother then raised her. Unfortunately, around this time, to be a trans child was not easy. So she just FYI, she was born AMAB, which is stands for assigned male at birth. Okay. And like, you know, fun fact in the world, if you have trans friends or trans people and you're like, but what really are you? Like, that's A, not a good question to ask.
Exactly.
That's also B and C, not a good question to ask. You don't need to ask. It's really nobody's business.
Exactly.
But that is the term you use. That is how you phrase it. Oh, I'm AMAB or I'm AFAB.
Yeah, just for context, you know, for you people.
Right. So. And the person who needs to know that is their doctor.
Yeah.
Everyone else doesn't need to know that.
Yeah, they can fuck off. So
they can fuck off. That's what they can do. Yep. Absolutely. So her grandmother disapproved of her effeminate behavior. And when she was around fourth grade, she started to wear makeup.
I mean, that's too young for a girl to be
wearing
makeup.
That's why I was thinking too. I was like, fourth grade, girl,
that's too young,
wait
girl.
Till seventh.
Listen, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're still a baby. This. Tiny baby. Absolutely not. But that's like, you know, the mother in us. We're like, protect our children. So in 1962, she's 10 years old and she left home. Now,
no.
I know. It's. So I don't know the circumstances. Like, it said she ran away. I saw that someone said she ran away, but a lot of queer kids are kicked out of their homes. So I don't know.
10?
10. P.S. That's illegal. Right?
Poor
it's
baby.
Illegal.
No.
Like,
in New York City on the streets?
New York City on the streets. And that's where she was. She became, this is, trigger warning, awful. She became a child prostitute. It's disgusting. Listen, y'all support trans youth. All right?
Yes.
Support them now.
And also, don't kick out your children because you
for
don't
any
understand
reason,
that. Period. Point blank, period.
Right? If you're really concerned and confused, therapy. Get a therapist for your child. It's fine. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
Baby. It's heartbreaking.
It's a really, really heartbreaking story. But there were local... So my verbiage, I'm going to be saying some things that were normal at the time.
Okay.
So...
And I think that she and Marsha both use language that we wouldn't use today.
Yes. And she you'll see, was part of the transformation of the language to some degree. But at the time, they were drag queens. They called themselves drag queens. So that's why I'm saying it. In general, if you have a transgender friend, don't call them a drag queen. Thanks.
No. Yeah. Because that's the difference. We now know that there's a difference.
Right. Like, yes. Right. Yeah. And so they found her and they took her in one of whom was Marsha P. Johnson. So she was she was older than Sylvia, but because she was Sylvia at this point was still a child.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh,
yeah. So as they hung around together, they got close, and then as sort of adults, they were friends.
Yeah.
She was christened her new name Sylvia by what was considered the godfather and godmother of 42nd Street. I don't know who those people are.
Oh.
But it was like in their verbiage, a drag king and a drag queen.
Oh.
That they kind of helped run, created the community for people
her found
who identified
family.
In this way. Yeah, her found family.
Yeah.
So in 1970, this is when her activism began. And she participated in actions with the Gay Liberation Front's Drag Queen Caucus, and then later joined the Gay Activists Alliance when she was 18. So she was fighting for not only for gay rights, because she believed in that, but trans people were not included in the fight for gay rights at the time. And so one of the things she was fighting for was to be included in their fight. So this is something to note, that they weren't necessarily embraced at the time. Now, I read that she perhaps exaggerated her importance and maybe claimed to be active during the civil rights movement and the movement against the Vietnam War and the second wave feminist movement, and also Puerto Rican and African American youth activism, like with the Young Lords and the Black Panthers. But there's no proof that she did any of that. Alleged, I don't know. That's what I read.
Sylvia's like, yeah, I was there. I was there, in New York City.
You know, exactly. I walked past
them. I mean,
them.
To be fair, she may not, even if she were there, she may not have been reported on as being there because of the discrimination that particularly what they called the drag queens were getting at that time, the trans girls. Yeah. So I wouldn't be surprised. So there's a part of it that might be a little bit of both. There's a part of it that she just wasn't being reported on and intentionally smudged out of, her contributions smudged out. So that is also possible. Very much possible.
Yeah. That's a good point. I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
So Sylvia and Marsha had been close friends since 1961, and they co-founded the Street Trans. This is what it's called. Don't call people this, but this
don't
is
add
the
us,
name
right?
Of this.
Yeah, yeah. Don't call people this. Yeah, these are outdated terms. This. Yeah.
And if you want to add us, it's fine, but we have an argument. It was called the Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, aka STAR. I'm just gonna call it STAR from now on.
Yeah, STAR.
Okay? So it offered services and advocacy for homeless queer youth and fought for the Sexual Orientation Non-Discrimination Act in New York, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation in employment, housing, public accommodations, education credit, and the exercise of civil rights. So I think it's really interesting that they founded this. Well, they didn't found the sexual orientation non-discrimination, but they fought for it. And that doesn't include trans. It was.
Yeah.
But they still fought. They still stood on those lines. Now, we'll get into Marsha P. Johnson. I don't want to go give too much.
Yeah. We'll do Marsha. She'll get her own episode. So
now she has said, anyway, she was definitely at Stonewall.
Oh, yeah.
And she definitely was a big part of that. When she was beginning to receive praise of all of that, Sylvia was like, she was also there and instrumental. And then maybe Sylvia might have said something about starting the riots herself. But Stonewall historian David Carter, however, questioned her claims of even being there because she was making some contradictory statements. And Marsha B. Johnson herself denied many, many times that Sylvia had even been there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And so she was 17 when the Stonewall riots happened. And listen, she also had issues with drugs.
Yeah.
And
it could have been that she was there earlier and left and then came back, or, you know, could be one of those things too. So,
but when, you know, and hard drugs. So sometimes when people are on those things, they, it addles your brain. So I, you know, she's done some great things, but I don't know that she was at Stonewall.
she might be an unreliable narrator.
There are a lot of ways
because of the drug abuse and drug addiction, I should say. Because, I mean, she was kicked out of her house or left home at 10. So, of course, she's on drugs, like in the streets. And
I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Poor thing.
So, okay. So there was there's a gay rights historian, Eric Marcus, that Marsha had told him that in the hours before arriving, basically, they were basically like, no, she really wasn't there. But there was a thought that there was a Stonewall veteran that they were going to write books about it, and they wanted to add her so that young Puerto Rican transgender people on the street would have a role model.
Okay.
So he talks to her and says, they were discussing her claims of it. And so she, Sylvia, was like, tell them I threw a Molotov cocktail. And he was like, Sylvia, you didn't throw a Molotov cocktail. And so she was like, maybe say I threw the first brick. And he was like, Sylvia, you didn't throw a brick. And then she was like, how about the first bottle? And he was like, no. So he finally agreed to lie and say she had at some point thrown a bottle.
It's so funny because I feel like I have heard that she, because we definitely know that the trans girls are the ones who did throw the first thing or whatever, because they were like, fuck this. Y'all need to stop taking this shit. Bullshit.
Yeah.
But I love that this is an issue. Like, we're not really sure, because I love, like, you have to, in a world where that's so hostile and that has been so hostile to you, you have to be like, fuck you motherfuckers. I'm a claim whatever. Whatever I say happened. So
you're,
I love the audacity
living.
Of like, being like, yeah, say I threw a bomb. Say I threw a nuclear bomb. Say I threw, I had a Uzi. It's like,
I flew in from a plane, a helicopter, actually. I jumped out of it.
Oh my God. And this makes me love her more, because it's like, yeah, motherfucker, I was there. What you going to do about it?
Let me tell you what I was doing. I was burning them all down. That's what I was doing.
Power to the motherfucking people. I love
it. And then this really happened. And I think we have proof of this. I think there's video. It's the 1973 Christopher Street Liberation Day rally, mm-hmm. 4-year anniversary of the Stonewall riots. She gave her famous gay power speech. Now, Jean O'Leary was a feminist activist, and she was critical in her tone towards what they were calling drag queens, which we now know is trans femmes. And Jean O'Leary, P.S., has since changed her stance and has apologized.
Okay.
Okay. There was issues where in the gay community felt like the trans community was getting in the way of their fight.
Yeah. It's respectability politics.
It's respectability politics.
Yeah. They felt like they couldn't, it was hard enough for the gay people who could quote unquote pass also to get their rights, that the trans girls basically made that difficult because they couldn't pass.
They couldn't pass. Exactly. Yeah. And so she said in her speech, Jean O'Leary is critical, and she shouts, quote, y'all better quiet down. You go to bars because of what drag queens did for you. And these bitches tell us to be quit being ourselves. Yes.
Yep.
Listen, she says it better than me by like a whole lot.
She was pissed off because I think wasn't it something about like they didn't want them to march in the parade, or like at first they were like, oh, you guys can be behind us, and then they were like, yes, well, we don't want you to march at all. And she was like, fuck this, and she got up on stage.
Yes.
So
yes, no, it's yeah. So she spent her life fighting for this. So during the speech, the speech from the main stage, Rivera called out the heterosexual males who were preying on vulnerable members of the community. So after the speech, she was backstage talking to people about having been at the Stonewall Uprising. And Doric Wilson recalls that Marsha P. Johnson said to Rivera, you know you weren't there.
It's like, girl, why are you lying?
You don't
As the kids say nowadays, it's all cap. What you...
Is that what the kids say?
Yeah, cap is lie. It's but they say cap. I don't know where it came from, but it's like cap means lie. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Marsha confronted Sylvia about lying about Stonewall at this rally. And then Sylvia left Manhattan in the mid-70s and relocated to Tarrytown in New York, which is like, it's a train ride up. It's not far, you guys. It's like half an hour outside of the city if you get on the right train. If you get on the wrong train, I've done it. It's farther. Yes. So in those years, she lived with her lover, Julia, and they ran a catering business. She also hosted drag shows at the Music Hall in Tarrytown. And there's actually footage of these shows in the documentary, The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson. So I'm going to give some things away about Marsha right now because they have... Fact, Sylvia.
Yeah.
In early July 1992, shortly after the New York City Pride March, her body was found floating in the Hudson River off the West Village piers. So the police obviously just ruled it a suicide, despite the presence of a head wound.
Yeah.
I'm just going to get angry about that when we talk about Marsha.
Yeah.
Even though I'm angry about it now. Many of her friends, including Rivera and her supporters, insisted it had not been a suicide. She had not been suicidal. And people later declared that they had seen her being harassed near the spot earlier. They had seen her being harassed earlier near the spot where she was found. This inspired Julia. This inspired Sylvia to return to the city. I don't know what happened with her and Julia, but she returns to the city. She's homeless. She took up residence on the quote gay piers end quote at the end of Christopher Street and became an advocate for homeless members of the gay community. In May 1995, she tried to end her life by walking to the Hudson River. Mm-hmm. She did not succeed, thankfully.
She missed her friend.
I have a feeling she kind of wanted to go with her in her head.
Yeah.
She appeared in the Arthur Dong documentary episode, Outrage 69, which is part of the PBS series, The Question of Equality, which featured her gay power speech in the 1973, at the 1973 Pride. And she also gave an extensive interview to a gay journalist, Randy Wicker, in which she discussed her suicide attempts, Marsha, her life and her death, because they were very close, and her advocacy for poor and working class gay people made homeless by the AIDS crisis. Remember, this is the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
She fought for gay rights, for all LGBTQ+, all the rights, but she also fought for the rights of people of color and low income people. Mm-hmm. She suffered from systematic poverty and racism. So she used her voice for unity. She shared stories of her pain and her struggle. And she talks about how like intersectional. We talk about this all the time.
Right.
It's all connected. Right. she talked about how they intersected with issues of poverty and discrimination faced by people of color, which caused friction in the Gay Activists Alliance because that was mainly made up of middle-class gay people.
Yeah.
And
professionals and, yeah.
Yes. So she looked to amplify voices of the most vulnerable members of the community, which were trans people, homeless youth, gay inmates in prison and jails. Remember, sometimes they were in jail because they were gay.
Yeah.
Like, yep. You know, people forget like, oh, well, no. And also, if you steal some bread, like, listen, we all have human rights in all scenarios.
But yeah, I mean, and they're creating a lot of times, it's a vicious cycle, right? Like you go,
yeah.
I mean, there's a famous musical play, La Miserable. Okay, I know my French.
What did
is
you
terrible.
Just say?
La Miserable.
La Miserable. Mm.
Did I say la?
You sure did.
Please forgive me, any of our French listeners.
Mm-hmm.
La Miserable.
If you want to fund our trip to France so she can work on her accent, I will take her with me.
Oh my
because
God.
You can for both of us. Yeah.
But y'all know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
For
yeah.
a loaf of bread. And it's just like,
right.
Like the law is not just to be like, whoa, that's against the law. It's like, okay, why is this person stealing bread?
Like, right. Like something went very wrong.
Yeah.
Right?
Like
in the world where this person needs to steal bread.
Maybe a fine, maybe let them off this one time with a warning and maybe pay for the bread. Like,
right.
That's also part of what we do as human beings. Like
as
instead
human
of
beings.
Like, so a lot of, so my point is that, she was so powerful because she was advocating to your, like you just said that, for those who were very vulnerable without resources and that couldn't pass quote unquote, frankly.
Right. And that, I mean, I think that
couldn't
was
pass
her
as straight is what I mean. Like as straight, cishet straight people. So,
right.
You know,
and she gave a number of speeches about Stonewall and the necessity for all transgender people to fight for their legacy at the forefront of the, at the time called the LGBT movement. She traveled to Italy for the Millennium March in 2000, where she was acclaimed, quote, mother of all gay people,
aww.
End quote.
Oh, I love you got her flowers. I love that.
Right?
Yes.
In early 2001, she decided to resurrect STAR, but changed the word transvestite to transgender. Mm-hmm. This is why I share what it was, because it was her who changed it to transgender. And STAR fought for the New York City Transgender Bill of Rights for a trans-inclusive New York State Sexual Orientation Non-Discrimination Act. They also sponsored street pressures for justice for Amanda Milan, who was a transgender woman murdered in the year 2000. She attacked the Human Rights Campaign and the Empire State Pride Agenda as organizations that were standing in the way of transgender rights. Mm-hmm. She was very upset how gay leaders were focused very narrowly on not small wins, but specific wins that cut out the need for transgender rights, which I've heard, you know, I've heard that part of the reason they did that was they felt like it would be more effective.
Yeah. I mean, this is where politics comes in, right? When you're trying to get stuff, legislation passed, laws and stuff, it's about, there's always like a give and take. And because Sylvia is part of the very vulnerable part of the rainbow, she's like, I ain't got motherfucking time to wait.
And the reality is, she really doesn't.
She really doesn't. And, you know, and they're like, practically, what can we get past? What can we get through?
Because
they're thinking of those terms.
I see that. But
I see both sides of this. I really do. I hate to both sides anything. But she's like, fuck that. And it's good also because maybe they did need to be pushed a little bit more. You know, maybe they're being a little bit too conservative on what they were asking for. Because if you ask for a million and you get 500,000, okay, that's better than asking for 250 and getting 100, right?
Right.
So
and you know, it You know, pride is pride. There's a reason for the word pride.
Yep.
Right? And so we can't, we need it. We need that word, and we need it to focus on everyone who needs it.
That's right.
Okay. According to Michael Bronski, who is a fellow activist and a writer, she was banned from New York's Gay and Lesbian Community Center for several years in the mid-90s because, this is so hearsay I can't even begin, apparently on a cold winter's night, she aggressively demanded that the center take care of poor and homeless queer youth. She was on the ground floor of this. She just a side note about her life. She wrote that she considered having gender affirming surgery, but ultimately chose to reject it. And then towards the end of her life, decided to start hormone therapy. That's just her story, her journey. And I kind of pointed out, and the reason I want to talk about it is because it, none of that has anything to do with her identity as a woman, as a female, right? That's a, right. That was a personal choice she made. I think that's important. I think people, it's,
we know that now. I think right. back then they didn't really have the language. So
she died during the dawn hours of February 19th, 2002 at St. Vincent's Hospital of complications from liver cancer.
Mm.
Interestingly, on her deathbed, she met with Matt Forman and Joe Grabarz of ESPA, which the Empire State Pride Agenda people, to negotiate transgender inclusion in its political structure and agenda. Activist Ricky Wilkins noted, quote, "In many ways, Sylvia was the Rosa Parks of the modern transgender movement, a term that was not even coined until two decades after Stonewall."
Mm.
So there's a ton of like monuments to her now, and we honor her. I've been to one of them, which is new in May 2019. They announced that they were going to set up a monument in Greenwich Village, New York City, near the Stonewall, where the Stonewall riots happened. It's right by Stonewall. And it was, and it's there, and it's very cool.
What is it? Is it a statue or is it like a...
It's a bunch of statues. It's actually the, okay, if y'all been to New York City, there's a park outside. I think it's called Stonewall Park. It's right outside of the bar. And it's beautiful, and there's flags, and it's like statues of all kinds of people. And I'll see if I have some pictures. I'll post them.
Oh, cool.
I
love that. Yeah. Even on her deathbed, literally, she's still advocating for trans rights.
Yeah,
I just love that.
She really let a really listen from someone who came from such.
Oh.
Tragedy. I mean, there's no other word for it. It's tragedy.
A little baby, a little 10-year-old out there need to be home in bed with her teddy bear. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Oh, not out on the streets.
I want to end with what I just, because I think it's important that there's a scholar, Jessie Genn, who is a transgender person of color. She is an activist and scholar. She discusses how mainstream LGBTQ plus groups have routinely, not lately, but before, for too many years, dismissed or not paid sufficient attention to her Latina identity. She says that Puerto Rican Latino groups don't necessarily acknowledge her contribution to their struggles for civil rights.
Mm.
So that's like above my pay grade. I don't know much about that. But it's interesting to note. I think it's something that should be taught when we talk about those battles that she did a lot for her people.
Yep.
She's really an incredible woman.
I love it because, you know, no one's perfect. And I think even in the rights, in the, you know, for these icons, these civil rights icons, gay rights icons, you know, human rights icons, we expect people to be perfect. But I love, just like I love that little anecdote about like Like, people be like, girl, now you know you were not there.
I threw them out like,
yes,
cocktail.
I was. See, what happened was, like, she's like, I was, damn it, I was around. I was there at 2 o'clock, okay? Like, yeah.
So technically,
I was there. Just because it just makes her human. But I'm so glad she also, like, the tide was turning socially and she was able to get some of her flowers while she was still with us.
Yes.
You know?
I love that.
I love that. So, like, to see the, you know, basically all of her efforts bearing some fruit, you know, and we all owe her a great debt.
Yes.
You know, because the rainbow is here. You may not think you know gay.
You do.
LGBT, you do. Alphabet person, but you do. They just don't feel comfortable enough to be vulnerable with you and let you know. But the community has enriched all of our lives. And 100%. I'm just so glad that, that, you know, a lot of inroads have been made into, rights, for the queer community.
Yes.
And, you know, we're seeing them trying to strip it away and we've only had them for a little bit. So we got to fight the power, stay vigilant, vote. And local and national elections. And but thank you so much for sharing that. Because I think, I thought there was a documentary, but maybe there's one in the works because she definitely deserves her own documentary.
She does deserve her own documentary. I learned a lot, but I feel like there's so much more. I mean, there was some, I obviously didn't do everything, but she's fascinating. And she, something I didn't realize was that she was fighting for poor people, for, you know, Puerto Ricans and, you know, the Latino community, like, that we should honor her legacy.
Yeah. And, you know, cause Pride is, you know, now we have this fabulous month, you know, the corporations get into it and we have the parades, which are all great. So definitely support those. But the real work is in the legislation, in, you know, you cannot be unfairly fired, discriminated against in housing, jobs, all that stuff that's important to people's daily lives. So that's also the real work. And that's why we need to vote. So, but thank you for sharing Sylvia Rivera.
So. Yes.
Thank you so much. And guys, thank you for listening to us once again this week. Remember to follow us on all the things. Also, please give us a 5-star review.
Pretty please.
In the Apple Store. That helps people find us. Also, if you want to support the show financially, you can do that through our Patreon. And that is patreon.com/notoriouswomen. That's patreon.com/notoriouswomen. And Miriam, how else can they support the show?
You can follow us on Instagram and also TikTok. Is Notorious Women Podcast. It's easy to find. Also YouTube, you can listen to episodes on YouTube as well. You can like comment and talk to us and ask us questions there. If you want to DM us on our Insta, we check that. You can also email us at notoriouswmpod@gmail.com. That's how to find us.
Yes. And if you guys, we had two really incredible and funny ladies, apparently, whether they meant to be or not.
I don't think they meant to be, but here we are.
But go and support their stuff, too. You know, go and look up Sylvia's history and do your own research and go and download or listen to a stream, a Millie Jackson song, because you guys, if you need to laugh, adult laughter, because do not play it around the kids.
Do not do that.
Not the kids, but but on that note, guys, we will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.